We saw the vision that Ezekiel saw of God, and it came in the form, what was he sitting on?
A throne,
yes. That's good. And what's on each side of the throne? There's four of them.
Four wheels with eyes covering them.
Okay, four wheels with eyes to move the chariot back and forth. And what's next to the eyes and the wheels?
Creatures.
Four. Okay, four living creatures. How many heads they have, or how many faces?
Four.
Four faces. And how many sets of wings?
Two sets.
Two sets of wings. And it appears as a, what kind of a cataclysmic event? What does he see coming in the beginning? Okay, like a whirlwind or a tornado. And it's got lightnings flashing through it. And we depicted that a few weeks ago. Again, when he saw all of this, he just fell on his face. And then this individual spoke to him. The upper part of his body was what? Looked like a?
Like fire.
No, that was the bottom. Close, though. How about the top? There's only one thing left.
Amber,
yeah. So his legs are fire, and his upper body is amber. The reason I bring him up is because he's going to show up again in chapter 5, the same individual. Matter of fact, the whole vision is going to show up again, except this time it's not with a whirlwind. This time it will be in the temple like Isaiah's was. So Ezekiel sees this vision, and then God tells him in chapter 2 to stand on his feet, and I'm going to send you to the house of Israel, and they're going to be so happy you're there, they're going to hear everything you say, right?
Absolutely not.
No, they're a rebellious house. They won't listen to me, so they're not going to listen to you. And this is something we all learn over time. You can't keep people in the church with your wonderful personality and your friendship, because being a Christian is far too difficult for them to continue doing it just because they want to be a friend of a Christian. And so, and that's the situation here. Then the last thing that God does is he makes Ezekiel a certain kind of an individual, like you have in a city.
Watchman.
That's the best hint you're going to get. Okay, a watchman. And guess what? None of that's in here, so you're having to drag it out of your own head. So he makes him a watchman. And we spoke last week about whether we are watchmen today, and if we are, it's to a lesser degree. That's all I'll say. It's to a lesser degree. There are individuals who are watchmen. Are the elders watchmen over the local church?
Yes.
Absolutely. They're going to give an account of everyone. Is an evangelist a watchman with the opportunities that he gets to preach the gospel and to teach the gospel? Yeah. Paul said, I'm free from the blood of all men because I have... as I've had opportunity. But as I mentioned last week, we don't have to go out and knock on every door in Denver. We are not watchmen for the city of Denver. Now, God will bring opportunities, but let's face it, if God's made us a watchman over the 5 billion people in the world today, are we going to be in trouble?
Yeah,
we can't. We can't do that. So we have to limit it. But Ezekiel, on the other hand, and of course, we know, I mean, how many people are there? Of all the people that... I think the first captivity, captivity when the people were taken, how many were there? That's a long time ago, back in Jeremiah chapter 1, I think.
5,000?
I think the first time it was like 2,500, and the second time it was like 1,500, and it did come up to 5,000. That's probably where you got that number. So is 5,000 doable if you're a watchman?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's doable. And so God makes him a watchman, and he tells him that if I speak a word to you, and let's face it, are some of the things Isaiah has to tell them pleasant?
No.
And are some of the things we have to tell people pleasant? Church discipline, classic example. Are we watchmen when it comes to church discipline? If your brother sins against you, you go show him his fault. If you don't, are you fulfilling your responsibility? No. So you go. If he won't hear you, are we done?
No.
Take a witness, a couple witnesses. If he won't hear them,
take it to the church.
We tell it to the church. If he won't hear the church,
let him be a curse.
Well, not quite. Let him be it to you as a publican and a sinner, but don't treat him as an enemy, but exhort him
as a brother.
So he never stops. Once you enter the family of God, you never stop. You're still a child of Abraham. You're just a child of Abraham. We say out of duty. I don't know what the technical term. God doesn't really give it a technical term. They're withdrawn from. They're disfellowshipped. They are no longer in fellowship with God, so they're no longer in fellowship with us. So, again, this is all part of the watchman. And then we come now, and we're going to start tonight in chapter 4. And the first task that God gives to Ezekiel, I kind of looked because I thought, man, could he really do this? But it appears from all commentaries I read that there's no symbolism here at all. So God tells Ezekiel that, first of all, I want you to find a clay tablet, which may have been some kind of a brick, because their clay tablets that we've found today aren't like what we would consider to be a clay tablet. It's kind of a square. And he's to depict it as the city of Jerusalem. So he starts out, he gets this clay tablet, then he's supposed to lay on his side and make it into a battleground. So he starts out in verse 2 that he's to lay siege against it, he's to build a wall, he's to build the battlements, he's to set it all up. And then there's a metal plate. And I took this picture, and I'm glad I made it small, because there's a couple of serious problems with this picture. You'll see that a little later. Anybody identify the problems yet?
No iron plate.
Okay, there's no iron plate. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is God's going to tell him to shave his beard and shave his head and take one third of it and burn it and take a third of it, and he's supposed to do certain things with it. Now, there is a possibility that the shaving of the head will be after the siege. After the the time that he's stuck on his side. Now, if you... I did want to make one point. Let's go ahead and start with the introduction. It says that Ezekiel gives us a couple of time frames. So he tells us in Ezekiel 33 that in the 12th year of our captivity, in the 10th month, on the 5th day of the month, the city of Jerusalem was destroyed. Okay, so this is 12 years from now. So we're just getting started, 12 years. And then the last time date we have on Ezekiel is he is still working 25 years into the destruction, or excuse me, to the captivity. How many years are left after 25 years? 25 minus 70 equals... Can't do math? Come on, somebody can do math. 35. Thank you. Our engineer helped us out here. 35. So there's still a long way to go. 2.5 generations. Actually 1.5 generations. Generations, 20 years. And so it's 35 years into... All right. So in the middle of page 1, Ezekiel's 4-part demonstration. He never says a word to the people. He is introduced to them as a prophet by setting up this clay tablet and being forced to lie on one side and another side for almost a little over a year. I think it's 390 days. He is not to move. Would that be tough? Well, it'd be tough. But if you get paralyzed from the waist down, how long do you lay and not move?
For the rest
of your life. So this isn't beyond the ability for somebody to do. But it would be tough, except God says, I'm going to hold you there. You can't move. So you might as well be paralyzed. You're not going to be able to move. So he's going to be, in at the bottom there next to the picture, it says, this will be a sign to the house of Israel. Now, is it a sign if you don't tell them it's a sign? So clearly he's got to tell them God is doing this, because if some guy just lays down in the middle of the city, starts playing with some toys, and doesn't move for 390 days, what are you liable to think? So this he has to be a sign. So something has to be said to make sure that that this sign occurs. So again, as I noted, and you can read this later if you want to, but in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, he says, I want you to get a clay tablet, and then I want you to build this siege, but I want you to put an iron plate between you and the city of Jerusalem, which nobody can figure out what that's for. I read some different individuals and their opinions, and I didn't much care for him, so I'm not even going to bother. We don't know. We don't know why that he did that. Now, in verse or the next section, second, he is to lie for 390 days on his left side, then 40 days on his right side to depict the two punishments of the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And once again, somebody says, I wonder why it's 390 days and 40 days. And everybody waxes eloquent. When you're all done, they have no idea what they're talking about. So again, there are some things in the scriptures that we just have to say. Deuteronomy 29:29, which says what?
Secret
things belong to God, and the things that are revealed belong to us. So there's a line we can't pass. So the third thing that he's supposed to do is get three vessels. One has food in it, one has water in it, the other has originally human waste, but after his pleading, he gets to bring cow dung. So, and he's got to get this set up, because once he's down, guess what? You're not going to go get any more. So I want you to take, first of all, he says, in the first vessel is all the food that he's going to eat. And then, have you ever seen in some of the grocery stores Ezekiel bread?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is where they get that. I'm thinking to myself, okay, wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt. What's the proportions? Nobody knows. How can you make Ezekiel's bread? Does God tell us what it is? No. So they throw all this stuff together and they say, this is what Ezekiel ate. Well, they have no clue. They really don't know. And then the second vessel is to hold the water. And then, as I say, the third vessel will hold the human waste. But after Ezekiel pleads with God, he says, Lord, this would severely violate my conscience. I have never eaten anything unclean, anything that was torn, and I could not do it. So what does God say? Okay, he says, all right, I'll give you. And is that a real good replacement from human waste to cow dung? You know, still, if you cook your food on cow dung, I think I told you in Zimbabwe, when they get a guest, they mix up cow dung and they put it on the floor to make it really smooth and pretty. But when you're laying on the floor, guess what it smells like? So we were not, I was not particularly honored. I mean, I didn't say anything, but I just thought, man, this is kind of tough, because all you got is that little pad that you're on and you can smell it real well down there. So I don't know if you could taste it. I suspect if you burned it, it would get a little bit of a taste to it. So again, in the verse on the top of page 2, it says, you shall eat by weight 20 shekels a day. So 20 shekels times, and I don't know how much a shekel is, but 20 shekels times 430 days, because you got the 390 plus the 40. So is that a lot of shekels?
Yeah,
so this is a big container. And again, he brings the container, then he brings the water, then he brings the cow dung, then he sets up his siege, and he lays down and he doesn't move for 390 days. And at some point, the children of Israel are wondering, if they haven't already been told, what is this all about? And so then the fifth demonstration is given on the middle of page 2, and that is, take a sharp sword, pass it over your head and your beard. Take scales to weigh, divide the hair, and you shall burn one third in the midst of the city when the days of the siege are finished. What city?
The one he built.
Jerusalem. Okay, Jerusalem, the one he built. You're going to burn one third of it on the one you built. That's why I say, if he's locked into place, then how is he going to do that? How is he going to go get his head shaved? That's why I say there's two possibilities here. Either it's after he is released, he goes and gets his, because his hair is going to be pretty long after 440 days. So, and that very well could be. So he takes one third of it, then he takes the second third of it, and he puts it on the ground. He takes a sword and he just slices it into pieces. He's just chopping up this hair. Now, would you find that odd? So again, this is a sign. Then the third part, you're going to burn in the fire. Then the last third part, actually the second third part. Now, you ever smell burning hair?
It's horrible.
It smells really good, doesn't it? No, it doesn't smell good at all. So Whether the children of Israel are going to smell this or not, but he is, again, this is a sign to the children of Israel. Then he says in verse 3, you're going to take a small number and put them on the edge of your garment. So you're going to take a little bit of this hair and just kind of put it around the edge of your garment. And then the rest of it, verse 4, take some of them again and throw them into the midst of the fire and burn them in the fire. So this demonstration, as I say, goes on for 440 days, which is, a year and 2 months. And so the children of Israel are seeing this demonstration. Why doesn't he just go preach to them what God already said? They're not going to listen. So we're going to try something new. And unfortunately, is it pretty rough on the prophet? I mean, this would not be an easy thing to do, but fortunately, he can't move. So could he even think about rebelling and get up and go do something? And then you ask the question, how did he go to the bathroom? And I don't know. I don't know what went on there. But he is in this situation. Yeah?
Did he put his human waste in that jar?
No. He didn't have to use the human waste. He pleaded with God not to use it. So he filled it up with the cow dung, the cow manure, as we would call it. Okay, then the explanation. And the explanation is some of the most terrible indictments that you'll read anywhere in the Scriptures. And they're very interesting because they have some parallels in the New Testament. That's one of the reasons I wanted to spend a little bit of time on that this evening. Did Peter say something about if you know the way of truth and you go back? Does he say something about that?
Mm-hmm.
What does he say? Okay, it'd be better for you never to have heard the gospel. Then, what'd you say, Jeff? What was your point? Oh, Cameron, sorry. Your voice is
I said it would have been better if you had never known.
Okay, you've never known. Then he uses two animals. Okay, the dog eating his own vomit. Ah, what a pleasant thought that is, isn't it? But that's what God uses. So, as far as God is concerned, when you go back into the world after you become a Christian, it's a very nauseating thing, a disgusting thing. You are like the pig who's been washed. Now you go back into that filthy mire, and we think maybe it's just mud, but we're told that they urinate in it and they defecate in it, and it's just a very filthy thing that pigs do. And so the pig illustration and the dog illustration, they will pale in some of the things that are said here about God's fury and about what has actually occurred. So, as I point out in the right under the horrible and terrible explanation, it says the destruction of Jerusalem and Judah will not follow the normal path of a siege, as it is a special divine judgment, just like the flood and just like Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, we have several divine judgments in the Scriptures. Was Saul's taking the Amalekite a divine judgment? Mm-hmm. The only problem was the water and the fire and brimstone, can they change God's will? Can inanimate objects do anything but what God sends them to do? No. But what about Saul? Does he change? And that's why God is so angry with him and removes him from being king, because it was a divine judgment and he did not execute it as a divine judgment, which ruined the whole purpose that God had designed for it to have. When the flood was finished, who was left alive? No one. When Sodom and Gomorrah, when the fire came down, who was left alive?
No one.
But when Saul went out, he was told, don't leave anything alive. And what does he do? He brings some back. And that's why God was so angry about it. He changed the purpose of the divine judgment, and actually, he ruined it. So this is another divine judgment like that. And what's going to happen is God says, I'm going to do something I've never done before, and I'm never going to do it again. Now, if you heard that and you were in Jerusalem, what would you be thinking?
That's pretty bad.
I better repent. I better make my life right with God, but they don't. Now, one of the interesting points, and I wanted to make sure we understand this in the second part, is the second paragraph there. Some of these judgments are based on God is not mocked, a man will reap what he sows. These people have sunk so low in wickedness and ungodliness that they would stoop to do what others would never consider, to eat their own family members. How hungry would you have to be to kill your father and eat him?
Very hungry.
You think you could be that hungry?
I'd rather die.
I think we would starve to death. I don't think any of us would even consider cannibalism because we have a sense of decency. We can't kill someone and eat them. That's murder. But these people have sunk so low that they will kill their children and eat them. They will kill their parents and eat them. Their parents will kill their children and eat them. Now, is that something God wanted? No. But that's going to be the sign of how disgusting these people are. And so we don't want to lay this at God's feet. It isn't at God's feet at all. This is a problem that the children of Israel have brought on themselves, and many times that'll occur. Somebody will receive the due course of what they're doing, and then somehow or another it's all God's fault, and we have to blame God for it. When the reality is that they brought it on themselves. And so so let's look at a couple of points here in that verse, which is on the bottom of page 2, verse 6. She has rebelled against my judgments by doing wickedness more than the nations. And she has rebelled against my statutes more than the countries that are all around her. Now, this is one of the interesting, and maybe it falls into that passage in 2 Peter about the dog and the vomit, but when somebody comes into the church and they're bound for a short period of time and they leave, do they tend to go way out? Do they tend to just do whatever they want to do from that point on in their life? In other words, they've lost their moorings and they tend to do even more. And that's I kind of see that here. They are doing wickedness more than the nations. Now, why with God's commandments would they feel the need to go so far beyond it that they're more wicked than the rest of the nations? And I think Paul hit on it. Remember in chapter 7 of Romans, he said, I wouldn't have known coveting except the law had said, you shall not covet. And I wouldn't have known incest per se if the law had not said, you shall not do this. And I wouldn't have known. Are there a lot of things revealed in the scriptures that maybe people naturally wouldn't get involved in? But because they are bound away from this, that's the very things they want to do. And it's what we might call the grass is always greener on the other side. When God says something is evil, what does it do to it?
It's so much sweeter.
Makes it so much more enticing to some people. Carl?
There's a scripture in the Gospels that said he could put his hand to the plow and look back is not fit for the kingdom of heaven.
Right. And he also illustrates it with a famous Bible character's wife. You remember the story? It's one of the short verses in the Bible. There's Jesus wept, and then there's
Remember Lot's
wife. And she looked back, and God turned her into a pillar of salt, which means she wasn't just looking back out of curiosity or fear. She was looking back with longing. She's looking back with interest. So you people have violated my statutes more than the countries, and you have refused my judgments, and they have not walked in my statutes. Now, we're kind of seeing this in some of the institutional churches today that are breaking loose from the statutes and commandments. And how far are they going? They're just going right all the way off into it. Now, in verse 8, it says, indeed, I, even I, am against you and will execute judgments in your midst in the sight of the nations, and I will do among you what I have never done, and the like of which I will never do again. Therefore, fathers shall eat their sons, sons shall eat their fathers, and I will execute judgments among you, and I will scatter to all the four winds, or to all the winds. Now, we don't know what they did. We don't have all the details. We don't really know what Nebuchadnezzar chose to do. But as a result of some of the things that they had done, God was going to punish them in ways he had never done before. All right, any thoughts so far? Okay. Oh, verse.
Excuse me. Yeah, the point that you bring up about going beyond or not sticking with scriptures that's very valid. But once the door is open, there's no restraint.
Exactly.
You can go and go and go and go and go. And that's evidently what has taken place in a lot of things we read, where we're not really filled in all the bits and pieces, but we can know that there was a lot of skullduggery that took place.
Yep. No, that's exactly right. And as I say, before you become a Christian and you're not bound and you don't really know what's right and what's wrong, you kind of dabble in things. And then when you become a member of the church, you find out these things are wrong, and all of a sudden they do. They become more enticing. They become something. You've already got the youthful lust, and now it's a forbidden lust. So what does it tend to do? So when you break free, what happens? You just throw yourself hog wild into it. And so now the next passage here at the top of page 3, he says, because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable things and with all your abominations, I will also diminish you. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. One third shall die by the pestilence, one third by the sword. But the thing that I really wanted to look at is in verse 13, I will cause my fury to rest upon you, and I will be avenged, and they shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken it in my zeal. I will make them a waste and a reproach among the nations, a taunt, a lesson, and an astonishment. Okay, there it is. I thought I'd skip something, but it's at the bottom of page 3. So God said, I'm going to leave some of you alive. I'm not going to kill you all, because if I kill you all, it's not going to sink in. So I'm going to leave some of you to become a reproach, a taunt, a lesson, an astonishment to the nations that are all around you. So even the nations are going to be amazed at what has happened to these people. It's going to be such a severe thing that it's going to be a rumor that's going to go around. And we'll look at the consequences of it in the next passage. But I did want to put, I was going to put it at the beginning, but I thought, well, I don't really want it there. So here's your time frame, and I'm not going to read it right now, except just to note that in the first 29 chapters, we have succession, 6th year, 7th year, 9th year, 11th year. But then we start back with 10th year, 27th year, 11th year, 12th year, 25th year. So it's like Daniel, it kind of bounces back and forth when it comes to the visions. When it comes to the events that are occurring, we have a succession. But when he goes back now and he starts giving the visions in the middle part of the book, which I don't think we're going to spend a lot of time on. I really want to just focus on his life and the things that God asks him to do. Because as I said, there's a lot of food for thought here. There's a lot of things. I found something today that really struck me. I'll probably be preaching on it at some point. But now, starting underneath the time frame, who's the first guy that instead of prophesying to the guy, he prophesies to something else? You probably could read it there if you want to, right under a prophecy against the mountains of Judah.
Jeroboam.
When God sends Jeroboam, does he address Jeroboam or the altar? So you go altar, altar, altar. And then the altar breaks open and Jeroboam says, seize him. And what happens to his arm? It's all withered up. He can't bring it back. So, but it was the altar that this prophet who was deceived and put to death had come to reveal. And the same thing is true here. He says in verse 2, set your face toward the mountains of Israel and prophesy against them. Now what did the mountains do? What did the valleys do?
Nothing.
But he preaches to them. They don't listen. So who's he going to preach to now? He's going to preach to the mountains. He's going to tell them in verse 3 there toward the end, indeed, I will bring a sword against you, and I will destroy your high places. Your altar shall be desolate. Your incense altar shall be broken, and I will cast down your slain men before your idols. So it's talking to the mountains and the valleys, but who's it really talking to?
Israel.
It's talking to Israel. And again, this isn't the first time that we've read about this. That next verse there talks about the valley of the son of Hinnom. And I think I spent a whole class on that. That term gets into the New Testament. The valley of the son of Hinnom. Anybody remember what it is?
Gehenna.
And Gehenna was the dump in Jerusalem where the worm never died, where the fires never went out, where the smoke was billowing up. And Jesus picks that place and says, this is what hell is going to be like. This is what hell is going to signify. What you see at that dump is, and there's bodies of animals there, and it's a very disgusting place. Okay, so we get down to the bottom of page 3 now, and this is the verse I was really impressed with, because this is where he says, I'm going to leave you a remnant, you reap what you sow. But then he says in verse 9, those of you who escape will remember me among the nations, because I was crushed by their adulterous heart, which has departed from me, and by their eyes which play the harlot after their idols. Now, who is the prophet who is marrying a woman who's going to commit adultery against him pretty much throughout his whole life?
Hosea.
Okay, Hosea. And in the process of that, God reveals over and over again, you see how you feel, Hosea? Guess what? That's how I feel. That's how I feel when my children go to bow down to their idols and offer their children to their idols and commit sexual immorality in front of their idols. And here I was crushed by their adulterous heart, which had departed from me. And of course, with that crushing from adultery, what comes next? After the hurt, then comes the jealousy, right? The jealousy and the bitterness and the anger. And God, didn't we start out in Exodus chapter 20, I the Lord am a
jealous
God? That's right in that second or third commandment there. You shall have no graven images. I think that, or idols. Maybe that is the second one. What's that? Second. Okay, thank you. So I was crushed by their adulterous heart, and by their eyes, which play the harlot after me. Jesus say something about eyes in the Sermon on the Mount? If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. God's really concerned about. We have a psalm that says the same thing. I will set no unclean thing before my eyes because of my devotion to you. So when your eyes are playing the harlot, or your eyes are longing to do things that are, it hurts God. It hurts God because God wants our loyalty. He wants our devotion. That's what, doesn't every husband want that? And every wife want that? And so God is saying, I was crushed. So don't get the idea here that here's God somewhere off in heaven and he's completely isolated and he doesn't have any care or concern for us. He sent his son to die and now it's up to us to get there. That's not the case at all. God has a very, very close relationship. Now he goes on to say, they will loathe themselves for the evils which they have committed in all their abominations. So we turn now to the top of page 4. They shall know that I am the Lord and have not said in vain that I would bring this calamity upon them. Now where do we first read about the calamities? Okay, Deuteronomy, right? The blessings and the curses. Cursed are you. And then before Moses dies, he says, I know that you are not going to remain faithful to the Lord, that you're going to be unfaithful. And here's what's going on. And God tells him, you testify solemnly to them that if this is what you do. And he even lists there eating your children. So that's actually mentioned. And as I say, that's not going to happen unless the morality and sense of decency in the hearts of the people is removed. But I guess if you could sacrifice your own babies to a foreign god, could you probably get yourself to eating them? And so that's kind of where we are. Okay, and then the last point, let's just get this so I don't have to come back to chapter 7 again. the top portion of page 4 above the 6th year, it says, you son of man, thus says the Lord to the land of Israel, an end. I will send my anger against you. I will judge you according to your ways. I will repay you for all your abominations. My eye will not spare you, nor will I have pity, but I will repay your ways, and your abominations will be in your midst. Then you shall know that I am the Lord. Now, does that sound like something that might be said on the judgment day? Before we're cast into hell? That I will send my anger against you, I'll judge you according to your ways, repay you for all your abominations, my eyes will not spare, nor will I have pity. If you want pity, if you want to be spared, when do you have to get it?
In this life.
Before you die. Because once you die, can we change anything? Hebrews chapter 9, it's appointed unto man once to die?
Then the judgment.
Then the judgment. So, okay, I guess I'm waiting for classes to come up and there aren't any, right? So I'm waiting in vain for children to come. So I better stop. All right, thanks a lot. We'll stop there. We'll pick up in chapter 8 next week.